What the court did not do on its last day in session, I will do on my first day if elected president.
Civil rights will be protected. Racial profiling will not be tolerated.
Do you have the Medal of Honor?
No, I don't.
Why did you claim that you do?
So every Friday, we kind of check back in on the biggest news stories of the week. And this week, we can do that without ever leaving the steps of the Supreme Court. At the beginning of the week, the court ruled, you may remember, on the Arizona immigration law, the show-me-your-papers provision of SB 1070. They also ruled that mandatory life without parole for children under 17 was unconstitutional. And then on Thursday, of course, yesterday, the court upheld nearly all of the Affordable Health Care Act, but struck down the Stolen Valor Act. That law made it illegal to lie about military service. So joining us to kind of help digest at least many of the legal implications, Jillian Metzger, professor at Columbia Law School, and Ilya Shapiro, senior fellow in constitutional studies and editor-in-chief of the Cato Supreme Court Review. Thanks so much to both of you for joining us.
A pleasure.
Let's go back to the beginning of the week with the immigration ruling. And obviously, this is not the end of immigration law. But I wonder what kind of precedent this sets for states as they move forward. Jillian?
Well, I think it probably gives a little bit of encouragement to states in terms of passing measures. But that said, I think at the end of the day, it really was a pretty big win for the government. Even the provision that was upheld was very narrowly construed. So I think states and certainly state AGs, as they look at that ruling, may end up concluding that there isn't as much room there for states to experiment as may have initially been thought.
Ilya, your response?
It was sort of a mixed bag of results, and not just because Arizona won on one of the four provisions narrowly or otherwise. Most of SB 1070 has been in effect for nearly 2 years, and there's different provisions around the country that states are looking at to put in, and some will survive, some won't. But I think what the ultimate upshot of all of this is that we have a broken immigration system, and real reform needs to come from Congress, not from either executive action like President Obama did 2 weeks ago, or states legislating.
But, you know, Jillian, one of the things that people were really hoping the Supreme Court would do was give us some kind of clarity. Mm-hmm. I mean, Ilya's right. A lot of the problem is simply that the immigration system is really a tangle right now of seemingly contradictory decisions and laws. I mean, did the Supreme Court clarify anything? They seemed to kind of send it back to the states.
I think to some degree they did. I mean, they sent it back to, at least for further for application of the one provision they upheld, and also for further challenges, which are still in the lower courts. One of the things that they did clarify, however, was that Congress has broad power in this area.
Right.
And so I think Leah's right. The ball has always been in Congress's court, and that just emphasizes the ball is in Congress's court. So if Congress were to pass something comprehensive, I think it's pretty clear the court would uphold something that Congress enacted that they thought really did comprehensively regulate the area.
Well, yeah, let's move on to yesterday's decisions that came down. And, you know, I want to kind of step away a little bit from politics and talk about the Supreme Court itself. You know, for quite some time, legal scholars have been talking about this as the Anthony Kennedy Court because he's been the swing vote on so many cases. Do you think that we're now really going to talk about this as the John Roberts Court?
Well, that's the narrative of the day, and I've seen a lot of commentary in the blogosphere and whatnot about, you know, the emergence of the Roberts Court. I think Adam Winkler had a good piece about that, UCLA law professor. But I mean, it really depends. If we see a host of opinions in the next term striking down or upholding 5-4 things like affirmative action and gay marriage and the Voting Rights Act with Kennedy as the swing vote, I think we'll stop talking about the Roberts Court. So, I mean, it's really hard to talk about legacies or what this really means for the court long term. You just have to parse case by case. Certainly this case, this opinion, was very much unequivocally the work of John Roberts.
And Jillian, what kind of clue do we get, if any? I mean, I would think it's kind of dangerous to look at this decision as a precedent for John Roberts, at least, and look ahead to the cases that Ilya was just mentioning and think that he might, in the future, also side with the liberal justices.
Yeah, I think Ilya's right. I mean, I think you got to wait till next term where we've got a lot of big-ticket cases to see if this is a trend or a one-off phenomenon. What it does emphasize, however, is it is formally the Roberts Court, and that means that if the court had struck this down, it would have been the legacy of the Roberts Court. And I think that institutional role is something that the Chief Justice felt, and I think it does underlie to some degree how he ended up voting.
So, you know, there, I'm sure you've heard, Jillian Anilia, the reports that perhaps he changed his mind kind of at the last minute. I wonder, Jillian, if you agree with that, that perhaps it was coming off the news that the public opinion of the Supreme Court has really diminished, that people feel that the court has been very politically motivated, that maybe that influenced at least John Roberts' opinion.
I don't know about that. I mean, you know, you can try and figure out what goes on within the court at any length, and it's very hard to figure out. My own view on that is that if you look at the oral argument, I think he was in many ways the justice who was most noncommittal in his questioning. I think the issues about how this was going to play institutionally for the court were clear. There were also a number, at least three sort of very prominent conservative lower court judges who had come out and upheld the mandate. And these issues had been flagged. So it's hard to think that it would, of all the cases that could come as a surprise in the Supreme Court's discussions, it's hard to think that this one could have.
Well, Ilya, I wonder if you would answer the same question for me. Do you think that the Supreme Court has been concerned, especially since they've overturned so many other decisions?
Well, my response is very similar to Jillian's to that. I think, indeed, he was noncommittal at argument, and he was probably on the fence for a long time. He may have given some indication that he was more favorably disposed to the what has now become the four-justice joint dissent line. That certainly reads very much like a majority opinion, and Justice Ginsburg's partial concurrence certainly reads very much like a dissent. But I'm not sure. I certainly doubt that if he did switch, whether at the last moment or somewhere in the middle, that it was because of op-eds by the commentariat or polling. I mean, if anything, the polling has showed sustained, if anything, increasing unpopularity of Obamacare, and especially the individual mandate. So he certainly was thinking about the court's institutional role and the Chief Justice as the keeper of the court's integrity and what his legacy would be and how to perhaps emulate in some ways his idol, Chief Justice Marshall. So I'm sure he had somewhat of a conflicted course through deciding the case, but I don't think it's about the short term or even short term politics.
All right, so for both of you, as we end up here, looking back at all of the Supreme Court decisions of the week, and there were many, although obviously the decision on the Affordable Care Act is getting all of the headlines, which do you think, and let me begin with you, Jillian, which do you think is perhaps the most significant in terms of helping us to understand this court?
In terms of helping us to understand the court, I would think probably the health care decision. Again, though, it's a little hard to know exactly what to draw from it. In terms of overall significance going forward, I think it's probably the Medicaid part of the health care decision that is going to spawn the most ongoing litigation, raise the most potential questions of a federalism kind, and will need to be really seen how that plays out.
That's the Medicaid portion in which they struck down the government's right to remove all Medicaid funding from a state simply because they refused to comply with the new provisions. Ilya Shapiro?
Well, again, I agree with Jillian, and I swear we didn't set this up. If you hadn't heard us on the debate circuit in the last couple of years, we went at it quite heartily over the Commerce Clause and other things. But yeah, I mean, when the court schedules 6 hours of argument and over 3 days and issues 200 pages of opinion and surprises everyone and has these multiple things going on, clearly the Obamacare decision is the case not just of the week or the term, but of the decade or the generation. I mean, it signals important things both about this legislation and about jurisprudence more broadly. And as Jillian said, even if Obamacare is upheld, I think the ramifications for larger things, future legislation, whether regarding social welfare regulation under the Commerce Clause, or even more importantly, this new groundbreaking precedent regarding the spending clause, what strings Congress can attach onto federal funds, I think that will have ramifications for many years to come.
I think you can probably both agree that it's not going to be leaving the courtrooms anytime soon either.
I think that's right.
Jillian Metzger is professor at Columbia Law School. Ilya Shapiro, senior fellow in constitutional studies and editor-in-chief of the Cato Supreme Court Review. Thanks, guys.
Sure.
Thank you.